Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 7th of March. Before we begin today's show, we must thank you so much for making our winter membership drive such a huge success. We raised more than $915,000 from more than 7,900 members to help pay for WPR programs, and we also welcomed almost 2,000 new members to WPR. Thanks to all the members who chose Food for 40 as their thank you gift. This means that approximately 72,000 meals, isn't that great? 72,000 meals will be provided to Wisconsin food banks. So again, thank you so much for supporting Wisconsin Public Radio and your community. All right, here we go with all things political, which is jam-packed this hour. We are going to be starting with Eugene Kiley, who is deputy director of factcheck.org, and they have been doing extensive looking at Wisconsin's baffling budget battle. The second half hour, Ken Vogel, chief investigative reporter for Politico, who's written some interesting pieces about Wisconsin as well, and saying that the conservative assault on public sector unions really was months, if not years, in the making, the result of methodical polling, lobbying, messaging, grassroots organizing, and policy crafting by a coterie of well-funded conservative groups. So that's what's on the table this hour. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can also use an email if you'd like to do that. That is talk@WPR.org. Fact Check is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center of the University of Pennsylvania. Eugene, thank you so much for being with us.
Good to be here.
Is the state of Wisconsin broke?
Broke? Well, it does have a deficit for both fiscal year, the current fiscal year, and for the next two-year budget cycle that begins July 1. So it needs to close that budget gap, and that's what this whole debate is about.
One of the issues that you looked at is whether or not the state is on track to end this fiscal year with a slight surplus. There were some commentators saying that indeed that is the case. But that's not true.
No, it's not true. And this is that's one of the things that we looked at. There have been some who are critics of the governor who are saying that they were supposed to end this year in a surplus, and that was true when the budget cycle first began 2 years ago. But at this point, the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, which is a nonpartisan agency that does analysis of revenue and budget issues, determined that there will indeed be a deficit this year of in the neighborhood of $137 million. And this is for the fiscal year that ends June 30th.
Yes.
And the issue that's been there is that some have said that this deficit is a creation for this year's deficit is a creation of the governor because of the tax cuts that he had passed.
Right.
And we did look at that issue. And the tax cuts that did pass in the special session will have no impact on this fiscal year. They will have an impact on the next two-year budget cycle that begins in July, and the impact there will be $117.2 million.
In impact, what do you mean? That it will be a loss of $117?
Yes. In the next two-year budget cycle, there will be a loss of $117.2 million. So it does increase the deficit for the next budget cycle, and that deficit is in the neighborhood of $3.6 billion.
Tell me a little bit about how this project works. How do you decide what you need to analyze, and how do you come up with the truth?
Well, a lot of what we do depends on what politicians are saying on the talk shows and in their speeches and in TV ads, what the public or questions that they have for us, because a lot of subscribers who send us questions and forward us material and say, is this true?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened here. We were getting a lot of questions from readers about the size of the deficit, about teacher salaries in Wisconsin, about whether unions are going to be treated differently under Walker's plan to change the collective bargaining agreement. There's an email that's going around that's circulating that claims that Wisconsin's combined SAT and ACT scores are the second in the country. So that when we get all this material, we decide what it is we can fact check. We'll only fact check things that are facts that can be checked. We're not going to take any sides here. We're not going to determine that whether what Walker is doing is good for the state of Wisconsin or bad, just as on the national stage when we look at the stimulus, for example. We'll get criticisms from Republicans who say, well, the stimulus is a failure. We don't fact check that because that's an opinion.
Right.
But if someone says the stimulus is not creating jobs, well, that's not true, and we have a CBO report that we can go to and find out. And that's how we're looking at the facts, and then we go to the sources of the material. In Wisconsin's case, with the deficit, there's the Legislative Fiscal Bureau that is nonpartisan, that studies this issue. I was on the phone with Bob Lang, the director there, and he was able to both, walk me through the process, show me the documents, and so we're in a position to at least give people the information, then they can decide whether the governor is making the right choices.
Eugene, have you been able to do a comparison of states in the country, that there are the top 10 states that are facing huge deficits that are in the most trouble, and rank them by all 50 states, or have you not done that?
No, we have not done that. I have seen there was an organization out there that has done that, and Wisconsin falls somewhere in the middle. It's not the worst in terms of the percentage of the deficit as being a percentage of the total budget. It's somewhere in the middle. It's not the worst, but it's not in the best shape.
This has been the source of a great deal of controversy. The average Wisconsin teacher salary, and I've heard people call in to this show on this, is $100,000.
Not true. Yeah, we've looked at that. We've heard different variations of that. One of the most frequent is that the average Wisconsin teacher salary is $100,000. The average is in the neighborhood of $50,000 when you're talking about the city of Milwaukee. All the salaries and benefits, the state has come up with a on their website a list of all the 425 school districts in Wisconsin and the average teacher salaries in each one of those. They don't provide an average salary for the state, however. So what we did was look at individual school districts and found that there was no school district that was paying on average $100,000 to the average teacher. The only one that comes close to that is both salary and benefits in Milwaukee did top on average $100,000.
And do we normally look at salary and benefits when people ask me? Not many people ask me, but how much money do you make?
Right.
I rarely include how much money I have in benefits. I have no idea what that is, but it isn't
no,
money
I
that
either.
I take home. I don't take it home.
And that's been part of the confusion. Like Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky was on one of the shows, and he claimed that the average Wisconsin teacher is making $89,000. And the term is making, well, you know, technically, I guess the person is making that if you combined benefits, but the average person hears that as that's their salary. And there was one reader who sent in an email saying something about, you know, well, I got to go talk to my wife because where is the rest of that money coming from?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. What about how many states have mandatory collective bargaining rights? Do most states, what are the figures on that?
Yeah, this is another area where there's a little bit of confusion. 35 states have collective bargaining laws, and as a result of those laws, they guarantee that there will be a collective bargaining. And then once they have that guarantee, then the National Labor Relations Board can get involved if they feel that there's a finding that there's unfair labor practices. The other 15 states do not have collective bargaining laws. There are five of those 15 that specifically ban collective bargaining. The other 10 are silent on the issue. They don't have, they don't permit it, or they don't specifically ban it. So in those states, like Alabama and some of the states down south, they can or they cannot, depending on how that school district or how that municipality treats its workers.
I see. Are you, just to speak as a person, because I know that you're dealing with an organization that's looking at the facts, but are you surprised by the amount of controversy, the protests that have taken place in our state?
No, not at all.
You're not?
No. I've been involved in political reporting for my entire career. I was in a newspaper reporter before I joined Fact Check. And this is a major issue. These are serious issues, and the extent of the proposal by the governor is going to bring out a lot of people. Unions are very well organized, and if they feel there's a threat, they will become very active. And this is a major changes that are being proposed by the governor, and so I'm not surprised that this is occurring now.
We have a full bank of phones going, so let's take some calls. Eugene Kiley, our guest, the first half hour, deputy director of FactCheck.org, a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center of the University of Pennsylvania. And they have looked into some of the claims that have been made surrounding the budget battle in Wisconsin, which they say has generated much confusion and misinformation. And so they have checked a lot of these claims. How bad is Wisconsin's fiscal condition? How much money do teachers actually make? Does Wisconsin rank second? We haven't talked about this yet. We'll get to it in combined SAT, ACT scores. How many states do have collective mandatory collective bargaining rights? And the list goes on. So let's welcome phone calls, starting with Jim is calling us in Madison. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. And I got a question. How does Fact Check actually not mislead the information that it gives out? For an example, the state employees, it's been said in the press that they don't pay for their pension and they have pretty good health benefits, which is true. But if you look at the total compensation package of a state employee, it's been listed as 8.2 to 11% lower than the private sector. Now, if the state employees give up these benefits, paying for their pension and their health insurance, they're actually, you know, you add another 7-8% on top of that, they're close to 20% pay below the what they could enjoy in the private sector. But that's not being touted in the press, and even an organization like Fact Check, if they just simply state the facts, that statistic can be lost. I don't know how do you maintain stating the facts but still sending a message out that is, you know, maybe the bigger picture and more truthful of what is actually happening.
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, and it's one that's generated a lot of confusion as well. And we haven't taken it on in the state of Wisconsin. We did on the federal level when there were some claims being made that federal workers were overpaid, and we looked at that claim. And you can the way of looking at both the state of Wisconsin and on a federal level, for one thing, is go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and that's what we did. In looking at this, one of the sources that we looked at, because the Bureau of Labor Statistics does try to drill down and determine how much people are earning both in salary and benefits in the United States, government workers as well as private sector workers. There's also been a lot of studies done, academic studies that have looked at this issue. I think you're right in that the benefits tend to be better for government workers than the private sector, but the salaries are not as as good. There's also issue of even trying to compare the two because government workers, and I don't know if this is true in Wisconsin, it was certainly true in the federal level when we looked at it, are better educated, older, been on the job longer, have more experience. So there are all kinds of other factors that come into play.
So can you answer factually, or is there a lot of subjective thinking going on in this? Are federal level workers overpaid? Is it yes or no? Can you say?
We didn't, because we said that you can't really make that comparison. You would have to, because there are so many different factors at play. What we did was look at the claims that were made by both sides, which and the information that they provided to support their claims, and why there were problems with. With both of them on both sides.
Eugene Kiley, Deputy Director of FactCheck.org, is our guest for the first half of All Things Political. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next, Tim is our next caller from Milwaukee. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I'm a little bit glum about America's future because I just think that there are just a lot of people out there that are just fundamentally stupid in their thinking, and I wanted to compare and contrast how many liberals might have looked at one issue and many conservatives another. Back in the 2008 campaign, Obama was talking about clean coal, and it seemed to me that at that point in time it was easy for a liberal to discern that in terms of extraction or in terms of usage, that coal wasn't very clean and that Obama was running a game on us. In contrast, in Oklahoma, the conservative legislature appealed to people, conservatives, on the threats issue by passing a law that banned implementation of Sharia law in this country. But any guy named Slim could tell you that there are no chances of implementing Sharia law in this country. And even an illegal immigrant who couldn't speak a word of English would know that if told about Sharia law, would say, "Que Sharia, what never will be will be." And the point being, of course, is that the threat isn't Sharia law. The threat is the stupidity of people that can't discern these things.
Have you done a poll on how many of us are fundamentally stupid? Eugene, that would be an interesting poll.
No, but I think there's part of the problem is that there's a lot of confusion on these issues, and the public, it's very difficult sometimes to drill down and get at the facts as we have the luxury of doing here every day. Clean coal being an example, you use the term clean coal, well, just as in a way to try to present it in a different light. So it's the kind of these things are poll tested, these terminology that's being used by politicians, and they state things in ways that sometimes make it difficult for the people to understand quite, what's the issue here.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go next to Joe in Franklin. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Joe.
That was an interesting call, that last one.
Yeah.
Another point, and this is a little off subject of Wisconsin, but not really. I'm sure your guest knows that we sent back almost $1 billion. We're not going to build a train. Now there's just another notice that we're closing the consumer assistance program for health insurance, which deals with Badger Care and Medicaid. A lot of people probably used that program in December trying to find the best deal on their Medicare program. We're going to send back another $500,000 to the federal government. And yet, our entire Wisconsin Republican delegation in Congress voted to continue funding for the bridge up in Alaska that Stevens proposed a number of years ago, which is just one of the worst earmarks I've ever seen. Does your guest have any comment on that? I mean, what are we doing? We're giving money back, and they're sending it someplace else.
Well, I I don't know. I know we looked at the Bridge to Nowhere issue and what the story was there, because there's been a lot of questions about that. But certainly, whenever a state turns down its money, it's going to go somewhere else. Where it goes and why it goes and whether that purpose is better or not is not something that we generally get involved in.
Thanks very much for the call. There will be a $900 million cut to education as a result of this bill. We have an email question. This bill will affect class sizes. True or false?
Which bill?
The budget repair bill in Wisconsin.
I don't know. That's not something we looked at.
But it might be worth looking at, right?
Well, then you're getting into, you know, what the we could. We don't generally look at what was going to happen in the future unless there are some nonpartisan sources that we can look at that, like on a federal level, CBO, or on a state level, the Wisconsin Fiscal Bureau, if they've looked at this issue, if they've made a determination about what impact it's going to have.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, as you look at the polarized media today, you have liberal stations, you have conservative stations. They seem to have they do have wildly different opinions about what's going on. Are they fueling, both of them, incorrect information? Is one side doing more of that than the other?
Well, I'm not going to take an opinion on whether one side's doing it more than another. That's an opinion, but I think there are cases, examples that we've seen, and we've certainly seen it in the case of Wisconsin, where some of these left-leaning or right-leaning shows will spread some of the misinformation that we're seeing here. I mentioned Senator Rand Paul on the average Wisconsin salaries. And also on MSNBC, Rachel Maddow has made some comments about suggesting that Walker's tax cuts is the reason why that there is going to be a deficit in the current fiscal year, and that this was all generated by the governor, which is not true, at least for this budget cycle.
And one final question for you. I don't know if you've looked at this or not, but another good one, because we hear a lot of this. This is from Barb. This bill will ruin the middle class. Anything lost to public employees here will soon be lost to private sector employees.
Yeah, again, that is something that is her opinion, and it's not something that we would fact check.
And would you be able to fact check something like that, or is that too all encompassing?
No, I think it's too broad, too vague for us to wade into. There's going to be opinion studies on both sides that can make its claim and justifiable claims.
Mm-hmm.
We stick to the facts where we can.
And tell me, where do you think people can go, in addition to fact check, to get the truth?
The newspaper in Milwaukee, the Journal Sentinel, has been covering this issue extensively, and they've joined with PolitiFact, which is an organization similar to ours down in Florida, that has been fact checking the claims that have been made on both sides of this battle, and I think they've done a very good job of following it.
Eugene, thank you so much for being with us. Eugene Kiley is Deputy Director of FactCheck.org, and we are going to continue our All Things Political. Stay with us if you're on hold. Your phone calls will still apply to the next half hour, although we slightly change direction here. Ken Vogel is joining us for the next part of All Things Political. And Ken tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence for Politico. He has covered politics and government at all levels, from small-town cop shops and school boards to state houses, Congress, and the presidential campaign trail, traveling during the 2008 race with the campaigns of Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, and Joe Biden. He reported for the News Tribune in Tacoma, Washington, for a paper in Pennsylvania, the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, and spent most of 2006 learning about the U.S. Congress from the inside through an American Political Science Association fellowship. He's written some interesting articles as we've been looking at the influence of well-funded conservative groups on buses making their way through the state of Wisconsin, and perhaps on policy in Wisconsin. He writes in a current Politico column that the assault on public sector unions that seemed to explode out of nowhere in Wisconsin and spread through the Midwest was in fact months, if not years, in the making, the result of methodical polling, lobbying, messaging, grassroots organizing, and policy crafting by a coterie of well-funded conservative groups. He quotes Tim Phillips, president of Americans for Prosperity. We go back a long way on this in Wisconsin. This group has been the focus of liberal outrage due to its well-known connection to and funding from, he writes, the billionaire industrialist David and Charles Koch. And they are to play, he writes in yet another column, a much more significant role in the elections of 2012. We're trying to reach him right now. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address, feel free to continue to use that, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Our number two of our show, it's been a long time since we've talked about books. And to tell you the truth, I hate to admit this, I haven't been able to read any books except for upcoming shows the last few weeks because attention has been focused on all that's going on in Wisconsin, and that has involved a whole lot of reading. Daniel Golden will be joining us from Boswell Books, located here in Milwaukee. He is an avid reader, and he will be looking at what's coming out soon in nonfiction. He will look at history books for us. He will look at fiction. He will look at mystery and all kinds of other books. So that's going to be coming up the second hour of our program today. Before all of this crisis, we did have some really good books, which I want to see if he's read these. Walter Mondale's book was great. I really liked Adlai Stevenson III's book. I liked all that was included in that book and all the quotes that you can use for years to come from that book. Ron Reagan's book on his father at 100 is a lovely book. And Washington, A Life, bestseller, Ron Chernow's book, also very, very good. So we are trying to track down Ken Vogel, and we do have him now, and we'll be taking phone calls for him as we talk about what he's written about recently. And we thank you very much, Ken, for joining us. Hi.
Hey, great to be with you.
Hi. Yeah, great to have you here. You've taught me something new here when you write about the assault on public sector unions in a recent column, that it was years in the making, certainly months, but maybe years in the making. How was it years in the making?
Well, this is something that a number of the top conservative donors in the country, as well as some of the groups that they've long steered millions, tens of millions, in some cases hundreds of millions of dollars to, have identified as a fight that they want to pick, basically. And, you know, they've long sort of cast it as an ideological one, wherein, you know, they believe that a number of states are sort of crippled in their budgeting by these liabilities to state unions, to state worker unions. And so they've said that this is something, reducing state worker salaries as well as collective bargaining agreements in some case, or collective bargaining power in some cases, is something that they want to take on sort of philosophical grounds. However, there's an undeniable political undertone here, which is that by depriving state worker unions of either salary benefits or collective bargaining power, they're also striking at a real sort of pillar of democratic support. That is, public sector unions have long been among the biggest donors and sort of most active supporters from get-out-the-vote standpoint and otherwise of Democrats in elections.
Talk about the connection of the Koch brothers. Everybody in this audience is quite familiar with the prank phone call that came from David Koch. But it said a lot, that phone call did. And I'm wondering what kind of money is at play in Wisconsin, and what kind of money is at play from them for helping to fund the ads that come from one side of this debate. There are other ads that look at the other, but I'm amazed how many ads there are on this issue and how much money is being fueled for 2012.
Yeah, the Koch brothers have long been, when we talked about this sort of divide, where there's a clear sort of philosophical, ideological place for small government, free market conservatives who are big donors, like the Koch brothers, to weigh in where they can say, hey, this is something that is very much consistent with our ideology, but also to be sort of making a political case and taking a stance that helps them politically. Well, the Koch brothers are really at the fore of that. They have long been among the biggest donors to some of these sort of free market think tanks and organizing outfits. I'm talking about Cato Institute. They basically started that. A number of chairs of or centers, academic centers at law schools that take sort of a free market, small government approach, George Mason University. The Kochs put in the seed funding that established the Mercatus Center there, which is really a leader in advocating from a legal perspective some of these positions. However, the Kochs have also ramped up in recent years their giving to Americans for Prosperity and other groups that take sort of more of an organizing, boots-on-the-ground activist tact, and you're seeing that really play out in Wisconsin. In fact, the Wisconsin branch of Americans for Prosperity was one of the first ones that they established in 2005 after establishing Americans for Prosperity. The Kochs, David Koch in particular, really at the fore of that. And now you're seeing that bear out, where Americans for Prosperity has paid to air $340,000 worth of television ads, in addition to radio ads in Wisconsin, to sort of to push the anti-union side of this fight. And this is really just the beginning, because the Kochs are promising to spend upwards of $90 million in the run-up to the 2012 presidential campaign. And this is sort of both an effort that could help them. It could sort of minimize or diminish the power of unions in the run-up to 2012, unions being a real counterweight to the activism that they've been involved with, but also sort of a messaging test ground. If this issue works here, that is taking on the unions and presenting public workers as sort of part of the problem and part of the enemy, frankly, then I think you can expect to see it in other states.
And do you think that they thought that they were going to do well with this issue in the state of Wisconsin? I'm wondering why they chose Wisconsin, which also has, as most people know, a very, very long history of labor activism and a real commitment to unions. And actually, AFSCME was founded here in the state of Wisconsin. Why do they choose us? And do you think that people are surprised, the Koch brothers and others from these organizations, at how people have responded to the idea?
Well, there's definitely a philosophical underpinning there. I mean, you say that it's sort of counterintuitive that they would choose a state where unions
right.
have been so strong traditionally. But in fact, talking with some of the key organizers behind this effort, including a guy by the name of Ned Ryan. His father was actually a congressman from Kansas and a great distance runner. But his group, American Majority, has this site, Stand With Walker. They were also sort of the leading group in organizing that Tea Party counter rally at the state capitol a few weeks ago. And he says, what better place than the birthplace of progressivism to pick this fight and to really have this debate about the role of unions and the role of public workers in sharing responsibility and, you know, being a budgeting challenge for these states. And then also there's just a practical aspect of it as well. I mean, they were looking for states that had long been in Democratic control, where they had been trying to lay the groundwork for this argument by funding these think tanks that could make the case that Democratic governors and Democratic-controlled legislators have been sort of giving away the store to public sector unions, and they had been very actively doing that in Wisconsin through the there's a policy center there, as well as the MacGyver Institute, a big recipient of funds from the Bradley Foundation, some of these other national conservative institutional donors. And then Wisconsin, as well as a few other states, but maybe not as completely as Wisconsin, flipped to Republican control in the 2010 midterm elections. And so this was their opportunity. This was their moment to get some of these lawmakers, some of these legislative candidates who were newly elected to the legislature, and also to get statewide public officials, including Governor Walker.
Oh, they got them all, yeah.
Right, to live up to some of the rhetoric and some of the arguments that they've been making for years when they were out of power about the problems that unions pose. Here was their chance, and they took it.
But they have to be in meetings now, whoever, wherever, saying, ooh, what are we going to do now? We have massive numbers of people protesting day after day after day after day. We have perhaps historic recall elections. And just from looking at this, I think the fervor is more on the side of recall elections for those who would support a budget repair bill. We've got a Senate that can't function. We've got people worried about schools, et cetera. Everything is kind of up for grabs. Are they re-strategizing now?
I don't think that they are. I think that they're still willing to sort of play this thing. I mean, they did polls and they did focus groups as far back as 2009 when Governor Christie, the newly elected Republican governor of the state of New Jersey, similar instance to Walker, having taken over for after a long period of Democratic control of the governor's mansion there with increased legislative power for Republicans. He took on the unions. He was really kind of the forerunner of this. And, you know, there was definitely some of these same issues were raised. You know, is Governor Christie sort of losing the public here? They did focus groups, so they found that, yes, there are, you know, this is, in fact, a deeply polarizing issue. However, even those who disagree with Governor Christie's stance in taking on the teachers union was the one that he really took on, but public sector unions more generally in the state of New Jersey, even those who disagree with that still respected him for making tough decisions. So that ended up redounding to his benefit in New Jersey. Now Governor Christie is sort of regarded as a national star for Republicans. In fact, many are urging him to run for president or vice president in 2012, which seems unlikely. So Governor Walker's in some ways following this model, and there's definitely a gamble here. I mean, we're already seeing in public opinion polls, folks, you know, there are definitely folks who are unhappy. Folks do support, majorities do support collective bargaining in principle. What they are betting on here is that they can sort of leverage the specifics of the situation to show that Republicans are the ones willing to make the tough and sometimes unpopular decisions necessary to move this state forward. So you're right. I mean, it's very much up in the air, though, and it could end up hurting Republicans. But again, this gets back to what we talked about, where conservatives have long been building for this fight, and in some ways is part of a longer-term strategy for them. And some of the conservative donors, perhaps the folks controlling the Koch's purse strings, are willing to gamble that, hey, even if this hurts Governor Walker and hurts Republican state lawmakers in Wisconsin now, they think it's part of a long-term shift in their direction.
Yeah. It's hard to believe. I don't think people understand Wisconsin that well. The statue in the State House is of Fighting Bob La Follette. That tradition goes way, way back. It's not of Joe McCarthy. It's not of people who have been this drastic, I think, with how they would reshape the state of Wisconsin. And it's hard for me to imagine, and maybe it will change how these people are going to be thought of as the people who are making the tough decisions when the ramifications of those decisions are so widespread.
Yeah, and their challenge is, again, it's long term. They almost, you know, wherever this fight would have occurred, they would have poured all this money in for advertising. And so it happened to occur in Wisconsin. And I agree with you to some extent. It sort of misses the larger context here of the state. But it's like when you have operatives who come in, and I've covered state government, not in Wisconsin, although I did go to school there, but in Washington State, in Connecticut, in Pennsylvania, and you would see operatives come out either from Washington, D.C. to run congressional campaigns in some far-flung district in northwestern Pennsylvania, Erie, or you'd see state legislative operatives coming out of Harrisburg to, you know, southwestern Pennsylvania to run a state legislative race there. And the locals would always say, you know, you just don't understand the sort of broader context, what's going on here, and it would help you to have this understanding. And they would respond back, usually not to these folks' face, because it's important, obviously, to cultivate the locals when you're doing something like this, but behind closed doors, and say, it's the same everywhere. It's just a cookie-cutter strategy. You just need to know how to apply it. And I think there's an aspect of that in Wisconsin, where conservatives are just, they were looking for a place to have this fight. Wisconsin ended up being the first place where it arose, so they were willing to have the fight there, and maybe it isn't the best place. I mean, maybe some of these traditions that you talk about make it a bad example, and maybe that will redound to the unions and their allies' benefits in the long term, because perhaps those conditions would work against Governor Walker's fight being successful, and then maybe it would maybe folks around the country would abort their efforts in other states. Mm. I think it's very sort of very fluid, and Wisconsin people are watching it.
Oh yeah, every day I wake up and I wonder what will happen next, and I wonder that all the time. It's one of the reasons I do what I do. But what will happen next in this one? It's who knows. Let's go to phone calls. Bill in Wild Rose. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, there's been a lot of claims made why you shouldn't have public employee unions, because they have the political power to put people in office that will give them favorable contracts. Is there really any facts to back this up?
Well, I mean, certainly. To everyone else who is, you know, active in the legislative or in the electoral process. You know, certainly there are selfless folks who are just working on this out of principle. But if you think about any number of the groups that weigh in, whether it's, you know, broadcasters or, you know, who want a certain place in the spectrum from the FCC, or whether it's defense contractors, I'm speaking more now about the federal politics. But the same thing could be said of the states, where, you know, any number of these interest groups, and that's frankly what a union is. It represents people. Tries to get the best possible conditions and contracts for these people, and does so by leveraging all the avenues available to it, including the electoral process. So I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. In fact, it's constitutionally protected, the right to petition your government, the right to have a voice in elections. Certainly Republicans and conservatives have tried to present that as some kind of devious effort to manipulate, but you know, you see it across the political spectrum, groups weighing in elections to get what they want from the government that they elect.
Thanks, Bill. Ellen in Milwaukee. Hi, Ellen.
Hello there.
Hi.
First of all, I'd like to say how ashamed I am of the people in Wisconsin for suddenly jumping to the Republican side, but I think it was done out of fear. And I think that they'll get some blowback and it'll change. But my question is, I don't know if this person you have on the air right now can answer this question.
Oh, he can answer anything.
Oh, yeah. My question is, we discussed in the last half hour somewhat that some states do have unions, some states don't have unions. My question is, the states without the unions, are they doing better than the states with unions financially?
I think that's really sort of an open debate. And, you know, all states have unions to some extent. I think the right-to-work states that have enacted this legislation that sort of, makes it more difficult for unions to flex their muscles in both politics and in bargaining. They're also hurting. I believe Indiana is one that's a right-to-work state, and yet they're still having this very similar debate. Short answer, no, all the states are hurting. And, I will concede that I'm not the best person to answer this, but certainly there are state budget analysts across the country who have come to different conclusions about whether having rules, laws, provisions that make it more difficult for unions to negotiate have helped those states or not.
Thanks very much, Ellen, for the call. More calls in a moment. Guest this half hour is Ken Vogel, chief investigative reporter for Politico. We should also say there are so many of our guests who have Wisconsin ties, and he is a graduate of UW-Madison. Just thought I'd let you know that. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ken Vogel, our guest. Could we go back just for a moment to the Koch brothers, who I know are also giving a lot of money for cancer research? How do they decide where they're going to give money, and what is their goal in what they're doing in Wisconsin? Are they, and who else do they give to? Do they have good causes they give to? Are they mostly political?
Well, in fact, in recent years, the lion's share of their giving has been to apolitical causes. David Koch, who you're referring to with the cancer giving, gave $100 million to MIT just recently to open a cancer center. He himself was diagnosed with prostate cancer and has been in treatment for years. He has given to a number of the sort of preeminent cancer research facilities around the country. And the way he framed it recently in a New York Times interview, actually I believe it was this weekend, was that it's sort of like putting a bet on every horse at the Kentucky Derby. You know that one of them is going to win. So this is his approach to giving money to sort of find causes, cures, and treatments for cancer. But you know, even at this event where he was cutting the ribbon for it, he's asked about, hey, what about your political giving? And, you know, at this event, people were rather polite and cheered. I'm sure many of them were happy because, you know, their salaries or their facilities improvements were being paid for by him and didn't want to call him out. But at other events, for instance, at the New York City Ballet, to which he has given, again, tens of millions of dollars, he's actually been booed as a result of his political giving.
Really?
So, you know, the New York Times story this weekend made some interesting, sort of pointed out some interesting paradoxes in saying that, you know, yes, while he is funding these cancer research facilities, some of his companies have lobbied to reduce clean air laws that conceivably could prevent toxins or reduce toxins that could cause cancer. So, you know, they say it's all very ideologically consistent that, in fact, they are giving to free market think tanks that, they will reduce regulation, their goals are to reduce regulation and to reduce taxes, and conceivably that could help some of their companies, but they believe it could also help society. They believe it would help society if their policy proposals that these groups are pushing would be enacted. But, you know, this is no comfort for liberals who, I think, tend to ignore some of the philanthropic contributions that are apolitical. Another one I'll just throw out there is that Charles Koch, his foundation, has funded the arena of the university in Wichita. I think it's Wichita State University. Koch Industries is headquartered in Wichita. So that would be a sort of very community-minded philanthropic effort. But again, I think for most liberals, this doesn't really balance. It doesn't jibe at all. Nor does it balance out their giving to conservative political causes. And it should be noted that their giving to conservative political causes has also increased in recent years, at least as a total percentage of what they've given, because there's sort of less giving to these more academic, wonky think tanks, and more giving to some of these more activist groups that have played a role in elections and could play an increasing role thanks to this 2010 Supreme Court decision, Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, which allowed direct federal spending on election ads.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to at least a couple more calls if we have time. Sam in Appleton, hi. Sam.
Yes.
Go ahead. Go right ahead.
Oh, hey, I was waiting for that other guy, but maybe this guy can answer my question. When they do the math and they say how much teachers get paid, don't they almost have to consider the fact that they work a lot less than the average employee? And then the other thing is, what about the bailout? Didn't they get a bailout last year for their retirement? Wasn't it like $20 billion or something? Don't they have to take that into account? Thank you. That's all I had to say.
Did you get a bailout? I'm not sure what you're talking about, Sam.
Oh,
yeah, I'm not sure of the specifics there either. The one point I would make, I said earlier that Indiana is a right-to-work state. In fact, it's not a right-to-work state. They were considering a proposal that would have made it a right-to-work state. And the governor there, Mitch Daniels, Republican, basically poo-pooed it, said no, he didn't think this was the right time to push for these laws that would have been similar to some of the proposals that Governor Walker is pushing in his budget repair bill. And so folks kind of looked at that and said, oh, this is interesting. He's sort of taking a more pragmatic approach than Governor Walker. And Mitch Daniels, the Indiana governor, had actually been mentioned as a possible 2012 Republican presidential nominee. So folks looked at this from two sides. Some said, well, it's great that this guy's pragmatic. Maybe that he would be, you know, a good candidate to run against Barack Obama. Others said, oh, there's no way that he would win the Republican nomination, you know, if he were to shy away from this fight that is really the fight that is sort of driving the political debate right now. So just a quick point of correction, then also some political analysis. They're not sure about the bailout either.
All right. Thanks, Sam, for the call. We're going to do a show on teachers because this is a huge issue, how districts will be affected. So we will do that probably this week. Well, Ken, thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, it was my pleasure.
Ken Vogel, chief investigative reporter for Politico, our guest this part of the program. We also thank Eugene Kiley, deputy director of factcheck.org. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up and we'll return and talk about books on the Ideas Network.